Welcome to Encrypted. I'm Lorette Love. My co-host is David Redding. Tonight we are very honored to have Lionel Fanthorpe as our guest. Lionel is a true Renaissance man.
He is the author of over 250 books, an actor, a singer, and a songwriter. He is the president of the British UFO Research Association, and he is currently director of media studies at Cardiff Academy.
Lionel, with his wife Patricia, wrote the amazing book, Secrets of Rennes-le-Château. This is my go-to book for Rennes-le-Château, and it's been in my personal library for 20 years, Lionel. I highly recommend it to every true mystery seeker.
And Lionel's website is lionel-fanthorpe.com. Welcome, Lionel.
Thank you so much. It's a lovely introduction. I'm very grateful.
Well, again, we are very honored. Lionel, for those who've never heard of Rennes-le-Château, can you take some time now and just tell us about the mystery and get everyone up to date?
Yes, of course. If I go right back to what I was doing in the 1970s when I first got involved with Rennes-le-Château and when Patricia and I first went to investigate, I was then working for the extramural board of Cambridge University, and I was doing a series of lectures for them on the psychology and sociology of unsolved mysteries. And I came in one afternoon, and there was a trailer on for the program which Henry Lincoln made round about 1974, 1975, called The Priest, The Painter, and The Devil. We watched that with tremendous interest and then decided that the Rennes-le-Château mystery, as Henry Lincoln and his co-authors had described it, would be an ideal subject for one of our lectures delivered for Cambridge University's extramural board. So our two young daughters, who were then just about school age, were taken over to stay with Grandma, who was delighted to have them, and Patricia and I set out for the south of France. We actually stopped off to deal with one other mystery on the way down to Rennes-le-Château, and when we got there, it took us about 2 days going down through France and really enjoying the scenery. And we arrived at this amazing little village. And there we met a very, very nice guy named Henri Bouthillon. And Henri Bouthillon was staying. In fact, he'd taken over a lot of the property that had once belonged to Béranger Saunier. Now, that little intro takes us and our listeners into how Patricia and I got involved with the mystery. Now, the outline of the mystery itself. Towards the end of the 19th century, a French priest by the name of Béranger Saunier, who had actually been born just a little way away from Rennes-le-Château in the village of Cuisia-Montezel, was appointed, after his training as a priest, was appointed as the parish priest of Rennes-le-Château. And within a very few months of his arrival there to take over his priestly duties, he became suddenly and mysteriously one of the richest men in the south of France. He had a stipend paid by the church up to this time of roughly £6 English money, something like $12 maybe, or a little bit more, $9, $10 for a month. Now, it was almost totally impossible to live on such a small stipend. And so Béranger managed to fit in his priestly visits to the villagers in his congregation at times when they were likely to be eating. So he would call at one household in the morning, have a little breakfast with them. He'd go on to another for lunchtime and just time it right for lunch. His third visit of the day would be with yet another family of parishioners, some of whom were nearly as hard up as he was, because it was not a prosperous area at that time. And what is so interesting about him as a person, when he came into the fortune, wherever it came from, he was extremely kind and generous and grateful to the people who had cared for him when he had such a small income. And for someone who had invited him in and had perhaps bread and goat's cheese and a cup of milk for a meal, once Saunière had become rich, he would hold parties for the villagers, and there would be 5-course meals with wine between every course. Once he had acquired his money, wherever he acquired it from, he spent as if it was going out of fashion. So the start of the mystery is that a previously very impoverished village priest suddenly becomes immensely rich. And we've got evidence of what he spent it on. He built a beautiful villa known as the Villa Bethania. And when we made our first visit there in 1975, we actually stayed in it because Henri Bouthillon was using it as a hotel. And it had once, when Saunière first erected it, been a truly lovely place. But by the time we got there, you know the famous Edgar Allan Poe story about the fall of the House of Usher? Well, that was the stage that Saunière's Villa Bethania had reached. And I can remember, I'm about 15 stones, close to 200 pounds, and I was going up the spiral staircase, and it started to come away from the wall. I got down without accident, but that was to show what had once been a luxurious villa was beginning to succumb to the passage of the years. But that villa was only one of the small pieces of evidence about the amount of money that Saunière had acquired and what he had spent it on. When he first took over the little church, which was dedicated to St. Mary Magdalene in the village of Rennes, the tiles were missing from the roof, windows were broken and hadn't been repaired. Birds were actually flying into the church through the missing windows. It was dilapidated, and there was no money to spend on it. But once Saunière acquired whatever his mystery fortune was, he put statues and paintings and restored the church to its pristine glory as it had been when it was new. Now, he also built beautiful orangeries, and he built a very mysterious watchtower. And in nearly every book or every documentary that has ever been made, television documentary, on the village of Rennes, that watchtower, Saunière's watchtower, is always a prominent feature. It's one of the most striking things in the village. And when we were in there and examining it, what was one of the strangest things about it was that through the window of that watchtower, you could look up and see the village of Cuisa and the center of Cuisa with its fountain, and Lumiere had been born. And it does just seem one of the minor mysteries as to why he built that watchtower where he did. Why was he trying to keep continual watch on his old home, just a few miles away up the valley? There is also the way that he lavished jewels and other luxuries on his friend and companion and housekeeper, whose name was Marie de Narnaud. Marie was much younger than he was. He was in his 40s when she came to work for him as an 18-year-old housekeeper. And there are those who have examined the mystery of Rennes closely who suggest that they were actually lovers as well as friends and priest and housekeeper. Because part of the mystery, we met the grandson of the man who had served as a verger in Béranger Saunier's church. And the old gentleman had told his grandson many of the strange mysteries associated with Saunier, which is where we got so much of our information from. And one of the things that we learnt was that Béranger and Marie would very often go for long walks in the countryside around Rennes-le-Château, and that he would come back with a rucksack full of stones, large ones, perhaps some the size of your fist, some even bigger, and he built them into a grotto near the cemetery next to the church of St. Mary Magdalene, which was his church in the village. And the information was that Marie seems to have been there with him to keep watch. And we also heard from the grandson of the old gentleman who had once been Saunier's verger in the church that when Saunier had been there in his study, the old verger had found a curious glass vial, rather like a modern test tube in a chemistry laboratory. But inside it, there was a twist of parchment, so it couldn't have been very big, only a few inches, square inches. And there was writing on it. So the verger took it to his priest, which was a natural thing to do, and said, "Father Saunier, I have found this when I was doing some cleaning work." Saunier took it from him, looked at it with interest, and then said rather dismissively, "Oh, it's only a holy relic of some sort. You can get about your other work now. Thank you for bringing it." But it was almost immediately after finding that twist of parchment in the glass vial that Saunier started to spend money. And one of the many theories was that it had actually been a plan or directions for finding the tombs of the Visigothic leaders who had once been in Rennes-le-Château, many centuries before Saunier's time.
Okay, so in its earlier days, what is now the village of Rennes-le-Château had been a Visigothic stronghold. And it was Visigothic custom for their leaders, when they passed over, to be buried with their armor and their jewels. Now, if Saunier had got a plan of where those hidden Visigothic tombs were, and the Rennes area, a mass of limestone caves, then while Marie was keeping guard outside, he removed some of the stones, get into the cave, find the body of the Visigothic ruler, and strip it of its jewels and other valuables. Now, if that was what he'd been doing, it ties in with this idea that he bringing back from these long walks with Marie a number of stones, which he then sent to a grotto near Semper, near the church. And the other was that if he had found valuables, he could very easily have cemented them between two hollow stones that he'd brought with him in his rucksack. So that if anybody stopped and said, "Oh, Father, what have you been doing up in the mountain?" he would simply say, "I've just been collecting some interesting stones for the grotto," and nothing would be visible but the stones. But that's one thing. There are many others. And they center on a mysterious tomb at the village of Arc, which is extremely close to the chateau. Now, when in the course of our research we visited that tomb, we found it was identical to the tomb in the painting by Nicolas Poussin, who was a 17th century artist, which showed three shepherds and a shepherdess, and it was known as Berger Arcadie, the shepherd of Arcadia. Now, what was particularly strange and interesting was that the tomb in the painting was an exact replica of the tomb at the village of Arc. And if we take the French version of Arcadia, Arc AD, it can mean, if we do a quick translation, Arc, in other words, the village where the tomb is, A-R-Q-U-E-S, the village of Arc, next to Rennes, Arc, the Arc has spoken, meaning, if you can find the secret of the tomb in Arc, you may find the secret of Sonnier's wealth. Just one of many theories. So that's the broad outline of the story, that an impoverished young priest named Béranger Sonnier, living on a very, very small stipend, suddenly becomes the richest man in the south of France, spends thousands, if not millions, repairing church, filling it with paintings and statues, getting himself a beautiful villa, building himself a wonderful town, building himself a range of oranges. It's amazing what he spent that on. And it had to come from somewhere. What was even more mysterious was that when he finally died in 1917, he died in debt to a furniture company. Wherever those millions had come from, they'd gone by the time he'd died. That brings up to another of the fascinating theories about the possible source of the wealth. It was known that he, Sonnier, was associated with the Habsburgs, and he had money in the Royal Bank of Austria. Now, there is just a thought that he had discovered an ancient artifact, something of immense value, that had some deep religious significance. Now, as a Roman Catholic priest, he could not hope to sell it to the Vatican, because anything that a Catholic priest finds is church property anyway. So he can't sell what belongs to the church in the first place. But the Habsburgs had at one time held the title of Holy Roman Emperors. The title had been done away with when Napoleon came to power at the beginning of the 19th century. But there was a sense in which the Habsburg family, who were the emperors of Austria-Hungary, had still taken unto themselves the title that had once been as of Holy Roman Emperor. And even though Napoleon had done his best to get rid of it, as far as the Habsburgs were concerned, it was one of the ancients. Now, Estonia found a religious relic. It won't say that the Holy Grail or the Ark of the Covenant. Something on those lines. If he'd found something that was inestimably valuable, and because he could not sell his own church, he took it to Austria and offered it to Habsburg, who then, because it was so valuable, paid him not an enormous lump sum, but a flea, shall we say, a pen. They paid him on a monthly basis via this account in the Royal Bank of Austria. Now, the 1480 war broke out. By 1917, it had been almost impossible for a French priest to receive money from Austria, the enemies, without being suspected of a spy. So the money that Sonier might have been drawing from the Royal Bank of Austria in return for whatever it sold to the Habsburgs, that money had to stop because of World War One, which may have been the reason that Sonier died yet. That's the outline of the story. So how can I help with further questions?
Yeah, and that's an amazing, complicated story.
Yeah, mine own book right now. Yes,
hello? Hello?
Well, I was going to say, it is time for our first break right now. When we return, we'll have more with Lionel Fanthorpe. You're listening to Encrypted on bbsradio.com.
Long before you and I were ever born, a mystery was hidden. A code was devised. A secret was guarded. It is encrypted. The truth about the Holy Grail. Who is 666? What is the elixir of life? What really happened on 12/21/12? What astonishing secret is hidden in the Declaration of Independence? What if everything you learned about history, everything you believed about reality, everything you trusted for your future is a lie? What if the truth is encrypted? EncryptedTheBook.com.
And we're back. You're listening to Encrypted. I'm David Redding, along with Laurette Love, and we are talking to Lionel Fanthorpe. And
hi.
Earlier, we were talking about the Rennes Le Chateau. And Laurette, you had another question.
Right. I believe that Saunier, another version of the story, perhaps, is that Saunier also found parchments inside his church.
Yes, this is another version, and one of the things which makes the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau so incredibly mysterious is that there are so many theories, there's so much evidence, and then, almost as if they were rival researchers, somebody will pop up and will contradict all the evidence that another researcher has put forward. But I'll give you the story of the manuscripts as it was developed by Henry Lincoln and his two companions when their first programs came out, and their book, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, by Bagent, Lincoln, and Lee. But when the first program came through, that was the one called The Priest, The Painter, and The Devil. The painter concerned was Nicolas Poussin. And Poussin had painted that famous picture that I told you about earlier with the tomb that actually exists at the village of Arc. Now, according to these strange manuscripts, which allegedly Saunier found in the church, there was first, a very, very complicated code, part of which meant that you had to arrange the letters on the coded script on two chessboards set up side by side. You then took a knight, a chess knight, and you performed what is called the knight's tour. Now, that is a chess puzzle in which you have to touch every square on the board once only, using the legal move of the knight, which is one square straight and then one diagonal, either to the left or the right. And by doing those legal moves, if you get the knight's tour correct on both boards, one of which is pretty well a mirror image of the other, then you can decode the secret message. And what it says basically is that the reference to the painters, that Poussin holds the key, only this is all in 19th century or 16th, 17th century French. And it says the treasure belongs to Zion, and that brings in another whole area of the mystery, the Priory of Zion, which may or may not exist, and may or may not be a secret society guarding certain religious relics and associated with Rennes-le-Château. But the reference to Poussin the painter definitely brings us back to the idea of that picture of Shepherds of Arcadia, or Berger d'Arcadie, and then you're back to the mystery of Arc has spoken, Arc a dit in French. Now, it also, in those mysterious manuscripts, suggests that another painter was involved as well, but fundamentally, it set out, for those who followed this theory, that the coded manuscripts were genuine, whereas a number of later researchers have said that they were forgeries, and that by following them in this version of the mystery, it was the way that Saunier found this great treasure. Now, where we're up with the Priory of Zion, who seem to be either a totally fabricated organization that was put about by the idea of a guy who claimed that he was their grand master and that they had existed for many centuries, possibly going way back even before the Christian era. And this mysterious priory held as one of its central facts, one of its central teachings, that Jesus had married Mary Magdalene, and that they had had offspring, and that when he was killed in Jerusalem, Mary, with the help of St. Joseph, had come across, Joseph of Arimathea, had come across for safety from the Middle East to the southwestern tip of France, and that there she and the children had been safe, and that one of the children whom she had had with Jesus, her husband, married into the family of Merovae, and the Merovingian dynasty were the first of the royal dynasties of France. So that the Priory of Zion, it was claimed in the secret manuscripts, were keepers of the secret of the knowledge that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had in fact been married, and that their descendants had married into the Merovingian royalty, and that those descendants still existed in our century. And there were various claimants who said that they came from that ancient line, and that therefore
many, many generations earlier, their earliest ancestors had been Jesus himself and Mary Magdalene. So that's where the ancient manuscripts came in.
Okay. Wow. And there were other priests in the area that were involved in the mystery.
Yes, there were. Now, there were, in particular, the Abbe Boudet. See, if before we come on to the answer to that question, we think about Béranger Saunier a little more. He was not particularly academic. He was no fool, but he wasn't a traditional academic. And it seems to be that he may have found the decipherment and decoding of the parchments, if they were genuinely historical, to be rather beyond his level of scholarship, and that he had gone to consult Father Boudet, who was a much older and wiser priest and was an academic, and that with Boudet's help, the manuscripts had been translated. Another priest at the village of Custoza, which was close to Rennes, was actually brutally murdered round about 1890, some little while after Saunier had become so wealthy. And the murder of this poor old man had been particularly brutal. And yet, paradoxically, whoever had killed him, and it had been done with an axe, whoever had killed him had then laid out the body with the arms folded reverently across the chest in much the same way as a funeral director would lay out a body in his chapel of rest. And the other person who would know how to lay out a body in the appropriate way would, of course, be a priest, like Béranger Saunier. So if he had taken that ancient manuscript, which had within it the secret of some unknown wealth or some unknown holy artifact that was priceless, then had he quarreled with one of the more academic priests who had been advising and helping him, Saunier was physically big and strong, and also, it seems, ruthless. One of the reasons for my saying that is that after the Second World War, so we're a good 40 years on in history from Saunier's death in 1917, although Marie lived on until the 50s as a very old lady. But under the lawn, outside Saunier's presbytery, the bodies of three young men were found, each of whom had been shot. They were never identified. But if we take that part of the mystery back to the Austro-Hungarian theory, in which Saunier had sold some artifact to the family who had once been Holy Roman Emperors, it was suggested that these three dead bodies in the lawn had been three secret agents of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and that they had got rather tired of having to pay Saunier and had sent three assassins to deal with him. What they had totally misconstrued was the idea that Saunier was rough, tough, efficient, and ruthless. They thought they were going after a rather timid, benign village priest. I could imagine the scene. The Saunier sees these three dangerous men passing the window of the presbytery, takes his revolver from under his pillow, shoots all three of them, and then buries them in the lawn before sunrise. He could well have been that kind of man. And we can link that in with the basic idea that he believed there was a great treasure hidden somewhere in Rennes-le-Château. Because those who had known him, and the descendants of those who had known him, with whom we spoke when we were there in the 70s, said that when the other young children of his age had gone out to play whatever games that youngsters normally play, hide-and-seek and so forth, Saunier had said to his friends, "Come with me, and we will search the woodlands for the lost treasure of Rennes-le-Château." And that theory got extended so much that those who held to it were actually of the opinion that the Sauniers, his parents, who had lived in Cuisia, had actually believed that they were descendants of the Merovingian bloodline, and that the treasure was rightfully theirs if there was any truth in that theory. But as a young man, as a boy, Saunier had believed in the treasure of Rennes-le-Château. He had also believed, if his parents filled him with that idea, that he had some extra right to it, and that he went through all the hardship of training for the priesthood in order to get the living at Rennes so he could look for the treasure. And it would also explain that when he found it, when he became wealthy, as he did, that he spent lavishly, as if he was trying to make up for the hardship that he had endured when he was a student for the priesthood. And he made up for it not only with good food and plenty of wine and luxurious building, but in addition to his very probable lover's relationship with Marie Denarnot, he also got involved with one or two very famous Parisian courtesans. So, having gone through the hardship of his clerical training, he wanted wine, women, and song.
Well, it seems like his whole life then may have been fashioned from a young boy and groomed to become this treasure finder, this treasure seeker.
Yes, I think that makes a lot of sense. He could very well have been encouraged by his parents to think that he was one of that lost Merovingian dynasty. Because when the Merovingians were replaced by the Carolingians, the usual brutal practice in those days was, if you were a monastic dynasty that had just replaced another one, you ruthlessly killed all the members of the previous one so that nobody could rally behind them and knock you off the throne. And although most of the Merovingian descendants were annihilated, it could well have been that some survived and had kept that more or less as a family tradition. And imagine saying to your son or daughter, if you had had it from your parents and they'd had it from their parents, "We are not ordinary people. We are descended from the Merovingian kings, who were in turn associated with Jesus and Mary Magdalene." Wow, what a thing to tell the kids. And what an effect that must have had on Saunier.
That's right. And, you know, the other aspect is that I've read about in your book is that he also, besides spending money on himself and his friends and his town, he also may have left clues in the church for someone else to find more or something different.
Oh, yes. I certainly think that one of the great mysteries. You know, when we read the work of professional criminologists and criminal psychologists, psychiatrists, we very often come across the idea that master criminals of various kinds have got very conflicting ideas about the crimes that they are committing, and that part of them secretly almost wants to get identified. So the master criminal will dare to leave a clue to his identity because part of him wants to boast about being a master criminal. Now, if we take this and apply it, this psychological theory, that if you have got some great secret and regard yourself as a superior being because you've got it, what you want is that other people should know just how vastly superior and intelligent you are for possessing the secret. And so, although part of him wants to keep the mystery a mystery, there is another motivation deep within him which wants to leave clues. And to those who follow that theory, and I think it's a good one, there are mysterious clues all over Saunier's church. Some of the murals which he commissioned, he also added little pieces himself. And the Stations of the Cross, which are painted all around the wall of the church, as they traditionally are in Catholic churches, look as if they've got certain messages. Let me just give you one quick example. In the Station of the Cross, in which the soldiers are playing dice for who will have the robe of Jesus, normally you just see two Roman soldiers at the foot of the cross throwing dice, and you can't see much of the dice. But in that scene, in the Church of St. Mary Magdalene in Rennes-le-Château, you can see the faces of the dice very clearly. And there is a three, there are three dice, there is a three, a four, and a five. And of course, if we link that in with a Pythagorean right-angle triangle, any 3-4-5 triangle has to have a right angle in it. So, is that particular scene showing us that you need to go off at a right angle for perhaps a particular distance? Maybe you have to add the numbers as well as having had the clue that it's a 90-degree triangle. But it's things like that in the church that make it look as if Saunier was actually leaving little hints and clues about where the treasure was concealed. And then, of course, there is the mysterious Dalle de Chevalier, which was found under the floor in the church, the knight's tombstone, Dalle de Chevalier. And that depicts a man on horseback carrying away a small child, taking him to safety. And there's a woman in the picture as well. Now, does that, or is that stone intended to represent Mary and Joseph and Jesus? Or is it intended to mean that when the Carolingians thought they had destroyed the last of the Merovingians, this tombstone says, you didn't get them all. One young Merovingian prince was saved. That's him, galloping away to keep the dynasty alive.
That's a very interesting line. On this note, we have to take our next break. When we return,
okay,
we're going to have Vinyl Fanthorpe. You're listening to Encrypted on PBSRadio.com.
Every day, 80 children and adults are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. Know the warning signs. Extreme thirst, frequent urination, sudden weight loss. For more information, go to jdrfbayarea.org. That's jdrfbayarea.org.
Lama Saiti Trugane Drawagi Kangalupa Dei Salagabashu.
As many as 3 million children and adults have type 1 diabetes. Join JDRF and help support the research that is delivering better treatments and ultimately a cure. Go to jdrfbayarea.org.
And we're back. You're listening to Encrypted. I'm David Redding, along with Lorette Love. We are talking to Lionel Fanthorpe. And Lorette, you had one more question for Lionel.
I do. Lionel, I was just wondering if you have any new research or discoveries on Wren and the whole mystery that you'd like to share with us.
Well, the whole mystery, I think we need to say, is continuing and ongoing. And one of the latest pieces of information was challenged as being a hoax. And it was the information that a researcher, or an alleged researcher, found when he claimed that he had discovered a tomb that contained the mummified body of a woman wrapped in Templar robes. Now, we were approached by a television producer, a filmmaker, who had asked us to come and comment on this newly discovered tomb. And I, during my days in the Territorial Army, was working mainly with cadets, but my main responsibility was to be the rock climbing instructor to our battalion. So it's one of the things that I do. I'm a rock climber. And I was approached by the television filmmaking company because it was said that that tomb was so dangerous that although they could get a camera into it, the kind of pothole through which you had to go to get to the tomb, and the rocks were likely to slide, was considered too dangerous to enter. And I said, no, to hell with it. I'm a professional, qualified rock climbing instructor. I'll tackle anything. And so I offered and offered and offered again to go over there and attempt to get into this tomb. And there was always an excuse from the bloke who claimed to have discovered it, that or you couldn't go for this reason or that reason, or he wasn't prepared to show the company exactly where it was. But let's just suppose for a moment that underneath what he was saying to us, which didn't appear to be 100% straightforward, let's just assume that there was something there and that this was all a kind of double bluff. So I'm still looking for the opportunity to go over there, if I can get somebody to sponsor the trip, and to see if I can find that tomb, that additional tomb in the Rennes-le-Château area, and to see what, if anything,
is there. Sometimes when what appears to be a hoax is examined, there may be more grains of truth in it than meet the eye. It's a psychological double bluff. If you don't want anybody to investigate a strange new Wren phenomenon, then you expose it as a hoax when it isn't. And by claiming that the reality is a hoax, you may discourage others from investigating that particular area. So that's the latest. I'd love to get over there again and prowl around to see what I can find.
Well, that would be great, and please let us know if you do that.
I certainly will. And may I just say a big thank you for giving me the opportunity to reminisce about our adventures in Rennes-le-Château.
Well, it's our pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us tonight, Lionel, and I hope you will please come back and share more of your knowledge.
I would love to come, because I was the presenter of a big show on British TV, which was called Fortean Television, and based on the great American researcher Charles Fort, who went in to examine everything mysterious. So Patricia and I have researched anything anomalous and mysterious over the last 50 years. I've got so many stories I could tell you.
And we'd love to have you back, really. Thank you
okay.
so much.
You fix it, and I'm more than willing.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Okay, folks. And
so
well, thank you,
Lionel.
Yep. And that would be the end of our hour. Our next show is going to be on July 3rd, same time. On behalf of Lorette Love, I'm David Redding, saying thank you for listening to Encrypted on bbsradio.com.